Blog Talk Radio.
Essentially work is
in a form of neo-slavery.
End mass incarceration.
Millions for prisoners, human rights.
March on Washington, August 2017.
No Shackles Radio.
Good evening, everyone. Welcome to another informative episode of No Shackles Radio. Thank you for tuning in this evening. Here at No Shackles, we are committed to protecting prisoners' human rights, re-educating the people out here about the 13th Amendment and its effects, and definitely we are organizing for the Millions for Prisoners' Human Rights March on Washington. I am your host again, Crystal, and before we get started this evening, I would like to take a moment to introduce my co-host and give them an opportunity to say a few words. We have Brother Christopher Black joining us this evening.
Yes. Yes, I just want to say assalamu alaikum, revolutionary greetings to the listening audience, and I'm glad to be here today, and I'm hoping we'll have an informative meeting.
Thank you. Thank you, Brother Black. And we also have Brother Malal Devine this evening.
Definitely. I'd like to thank y'all for coming, listening to the show. You know, we appreciate it. We appreciate the support, and I hope it be real educational and informative. Please.
Thank you so much. This evening, we have a great broadcast in store for you. We definitely will be engaging in great conversations surrounding mental illness here in this country, in our jails, in our prisons. We have a special guest this evening, Ms. Holly Austin. She'll be joining us a little bit later in the conversation. But definitely, we do look forward to a great show this evening. And as always, we like to open up with any news, any recent police killings throughout the nation. And just to tell you a little bit about some things that have been happening. On Friday, September the 16th, a Tulsa police officer, Betty Shelby, she fired the fatal shot and killed Terrence Crutcher. That was just on Friday, September the 16th. And then on Tuesday, September the 20th, police in Charlotte, North Carolina, shot and killed 43-year-old Keith Lamont Scott. Another tragedy. And on Tuesday, September the 27th of this week, Brother Alfred Olango was shot and killed by police in California. And one of our regular co-hosts, Sister Layla Aziz, she is out in that area. And so she has been keeping us informed and abreast of the events as they unfold out there, but definitely some very sad, tragic, unfortunate situations that have taken place over the past week. I did also just want to let you know in addition to that, in other news, on Tuesday, California Governor Jerry Brown vetoed a bill that would have guaranteed incarcerated people the right to be visited in person in jail. And, you know, right now across the country, this in-person visitation is disappearing. And so they are replacing them with this video visitation. It's a Skype kind of system. Of course, it costs money. It's expensive. It's not reliable. And so several legislation and advocates and activists are really challenging that right there, because this is absolutely essential that prisoners have that contact with their loved ones. And currently, Texas is the only state to pass its own law to ban video-only visitation. So right now in Texas, those that are incarcerated, they do have a right to a minimum of 2 20-minute in-person visits a week. And so that is definitely something that is terrible. You continue to see these changes that are happening, and the goal is to really keep the prisoners in the dark and to disrupt that family bonding that is so necessary. And so I did just want to let you all know that those were some things that were happening in our nation over the past week or so. But again, once again, I do want to thank my co-host for joining me this evening. And at this point, we are going to launch into our panel discussions for this evening. And I do want to remind our listeners that if you would like to join in on this discussion that we're having, please press the 1 on your phone, and you will definitely be added into our queue this evening. And as we get started, I did just want to mention that this week we received word that one of our prisoner advisors, Brother Jaleel Musa King, that he's being retaliated against and on the verge of being punished by prison officials at Attica for supporting and inviting others to join and participate in the upcoming March on Washington. And prison officials, they decided that warranted a sanction for him. And for many of those who, you know, may not know, Brother Jaleel Musa King, he is a political prisoner, a freedom fighter, he's an author, an educator, and he has been held at Attica Prison for the past 45 years. In June of this year, he was denied parole again for the 9th time. He has a very clean, unscathed prison record, and these new events could definitely have a major impact on his next parole hearing in 2018. And so once we received word of this, you know, we sent out a call to all concerned supporters everywhere, and of course they got behind this. They contacted the facilities. You know, we were trying to find out answers and see how we could really assist Brother Jaleel. And so we were able to speak with the commissioner. He states that he's monitoring the situation very closely. At this point, he says that he'll just let the case go through the hearing process there at the prison level, and that he will be back in touch with us. But, you know, if Brother Jaleel is actually charged for this, then we will decide, you know, our next course of action. And so I did want to thank everyone. You know, when we made the call out to ask you to call out there, let your voice be heard, you really did that. And so we definitely want to thank everyone who assisted us with that. We will keep you posted as details about that emerge. The fight is definitely not over. And so that leads us into, you know, one of our initial topics for our panel discussion this evening. And, you know, something definitely in lieu of the Jaleel situation, it caused us to question certain things. And definitely one of those things is, you know, I wanted to ask my co-host, should we be expecting more prison official scrutiny, political repression because of their desire to participate here in this upcoming march? Brother Malad Devine, do you have any thoughts?
I think that when you look at, like, what's going on with the brother, it's always going to be intimidation factor at hand, and 9 or 10 times it's done out of spite, because they know that, you know, that people, like, especially like the brother, you say he went up for parole 40 for four, he said 45 times or something like that, or been incarcerated for 45 years. So
he's been incarcerated for 45 years, and this was his ninth time up for parole.
Yeah. So they know and understand that, you know, freedom, everybody wants to be free. But they want you, they want him to compromise, or they want him to bend. They don't want him to hold forth to his principles that he's lived by. When they do that across the board, see, it's like the only thing they got to hold over you is that little bit of freedom, that little bit of I need to get out the air. So it's like if they intimidate him, other people will be intimidated because, like, at the end of the day, he's still a big fish. You know, he a big man on the yard, you know, and he got a lot of influence and a lot of pull. So they don't want nobody else because at the end of the day, you know, they want you to live on your knees like a coward. And because what is he doing and what are we doing? We ain't do no more than the exercise and the rights that they say we have under the First Amendment. And you don't lose these First Amendment rights because you were in prison. So, you know, it's just the saga continues, you know, and it's like it's unfortunate that this is what's going on. And as far as, like, getting actual other brothers to help organize the march, they got to choose their own conscience. And most people won't choose to do what's right because they see the overall goal. Because a lot of people don't like to be intimidated, and that's just going to enrage them even more. So technically, they might have shot their own self in the foot with that move right there. And, you know, that's how I see that situation.
Well, we definitely hope so. This is about the prisoners, for the prisoners, and we definitely need their participation and their involvement with, in this mission. And definitely, we are keeping a close, watchful eye on that. And brother Christopher Black,
yeah.
I know that. Should we be expecting? You know, what should we be expecting, and how should we deal with that?
Well, first of all, I wanted to touch on something dealing with Jahlil Muttaqim, brother comrade. Everyone has to recognize the fact, first of all, he is recognized as Brother Marla Divine just put out there as a big fish, you know, and intimidating him possibly could intimidate others. And I'm in total agreement that they probably definitely shot themselves in the foot with it because people don't like to be intimidated, especially when they know it's for the right, especially when you have the prison resistance movement growing so widespread today. You know, it's a reignition of the fire today. So I think this right here is only going to enrage that flame a little more. I do want to touch on the brother Jahlil Muttaqim before I jump into the answer. I want people to understand this case a little bit. You know, brother Jahlil, first of all, I want people to know that he actually technically should not be in prison today, period. We do feel like myself personally and a few other comrades feel like his entire conviction is based on the COINTELPRO, which is the counterintelligence program that was initiated by J. Edgar Hoover to undermine the Black Power movement or to undermine what some people term the revolutionary movement. And in some cases, they say this the rise of the Black Messiah that can come and use all Black people or just people in general bring them together to transform this entire system. But that was the J. Edgar Hoover plan. That was his game plan. This is why we had mass slaughtering of the Black Panther Party and other members of RAM and Republic of New Africa and a whole lot of other organizations, particularly even in the European area. We had a lot of revolutionary organizations or progressive organizations that was also came under direct attack by the COINTELPRO program. A couple people have managed to see the other side, which was Geronimo Pratt, which is a popular one. He passed in Africa. Johnny Cochran was his public defender attorney, and then Johnny Cochran years later went back and got him out, proved, you know, the evidence that presented the evidence that was necessary, including the cover-up by the government itself. And Jahlil Muttaqim was a part of what was known as the Black Liberation Army. And the BLA, you know, was known for a lot of activities, underground activities, and the government definitely had a hard-on for the BLA. So we honestly, sincerely believe that Jahlil's case is definitely was definitely motivated. The tax definitely coming from the government, and this is why he's in now, and there's a lot of covering up taking place. Just an example, his co-defendant, someone not his co-defendant, but someone defending him was tortured. torching to finger him and two other so-called suspects. And it was proven in court that he was never given a retrial. The ballistics of the gun he had came back to find out that it didn't even match. This was the FBI's own report. New York PD came back with an entire another report stating that the ballistics did match. And when they started taking through the appeal process, the entire reports on both of them just completely disappeared. But yet our brother still sits in Attica 45 years later. So I might just wanted to point those things right there out. But should we expect more political repression amongst the prisoners? Of course. Will prisoners stop? You got to remember, this entire movement right here is motivated by the prisoners. It was started by the prisoners from within the tombs. So it's not going to die. It's not going to stop those million plus from being at Congress doorstep, knocking on the doorsteps, telling them it's time to change this system. But I fully do expect it to be more. This is the first case right here. I expect that we'll eventually be getting more letters from different prisoners saying some issue or another that didn't happen regarding our newsletter or regarding how the brothers inside or the sisters inside are promoting this march within or how they even organize it relating to promoting the march inside and outside. So that is my answer right there.
Thank you for that, Brother Black, and I appreciate you, you know, informing the listeners about the history, given more details and information about Brother Jahlil Musa King. And another one of our missions with the Millions for Prisoners of Human Rights is to represent political and politicized prisoners. And so thank you again for that, but it is to be expected. It is to be expected, the scrutiny. You know, this is challenging. What we're attempting to do is challenging the core foundation of the whole prison industrial complex. And so definitely political scrutiny, political repression. And so we have to continue to challenge those things. We have to continue to band together when we see cases, incidents of this going on, definitely. And while we're on that, if you are aware or hear of cases where prisoners are expressing any sort of backlash for supporting the Millions for Prisoners Human Rights March, that is definitely something that we would like to be in the know of. So thank you for that again. But as we continue into our discussions for this evening, I do want to, we're tackling a very challenging subject this evening, you know, mental illness within America's prisons and jails. And as I mentioned earlier in the program, we definitely have a great special guest on with us this evening, Ms. Holly Austin. So we'll be talking with her shortly. But I did want to talk a little bit about mental health here and things. You know, at some point in the 1970s or so, Congress, they made this decision to close state-run mental health institutions. And, you know, that was largely funded by the Community Mental Health Act back in 1963. And the idea was that the funds would be redirected from the states to local communities, and they could manage and monitor, you know, the needs of individuals within their community. Unfortunately, this transfer of funds, it never happened. And local communities, they were just simply overwhelmed, you know, with these people in their community, people with mental health, and they did not know what to do. They turned to the prison systems, and the prison systems themselves were already underfunded and understaffed, et cetera. And to now transfer mental illness to the prison system, it really further complicated things. Prisoners suffering from mental illness, they often found that their conditions were exacerbated and amplified by their incarceration. And so what essentially happened is the trans-institutionalization of mental illness from hospitals to prisons. And so once, you know, they found themselves there, the prisoners with these mental illness, they become so withdrawn, they find themselves in solitary confinement, you know, oftentimes it's, you know, they design it like the solitary confinement is intended as a protective measure. But as a matter of fact, they're actually ignored, you know, left alone. They suffer a lot. And you can even imagine, you know, with no treatment programs, no rehabilitation that goes on in our prison system these days, imprisoning someone, you know, with a mental illness disorder is definitely one of the worst punishments that you could do, and it's terrible. We've got lots of issues all across the board, you know, dealing with our entire criminal justice system, but tonight, this evening, we have chosen to take on mental illness in our prison systems. And so I did want to ask my co-host this evening, firstly, why do you believe that there is such a stigma, you know, around mental illness within, you know, black, brown, poor communities? And I can just recall myself, you know, families oftentimes they deny that it, you know, existed, or they were very embarrassed or ashamed about it. Treatment was usually not an option. And so why do you believe there's such a stigma associated with this mental illness here? Brother Maladevon?
Yes, I think that before we even look at mental illness health, it's just in general our community as far as even going to get checkups and physicals. You know, when you look at, I think that the sister named Harriet Washington, she put an excellent book out called Medical Apartheid, and she showed that since we've been over here in America, how they've been experimenting on our people. So I think that, you know, the different stories that was passed down in each generation, it already made us biased towards the medical industry. And so if we're not willing to get checkups and all that, of course we're not going to see the mental health issue as anything other than a subsidiary of that. So I think that it's our whole interaction with the medical industry based off of how they've conducted themselves with our people since we've been over here. And I think that we got to get over that hurdle first before we can even really even see the mental health aspect of it.
I definitely agree with that.
Mm-hmm.
Brother Christopher Black.
Why? I agree. Okay. Well, I mean, I do agree with the brother. I would say this here, right? I really can't answer the actual why. What I can say is that I think there are some things that are deeply ingrained, and I think it is deeply ingrained from a historical perspective, with our interaction with the medical community over here in this country. And like Brother Mala expressed just now, you know, the experimentation and all that was taking place. But I will say these days there's a much more better uptick of an improvement as far as identifying mental illness in our community and trying to go out and get treatment for these mental illness. But there's still a distrust there, and there's a distrust because the more we become more educated in the medical area, we also know that mental illness diagnoses are over exaggerated at times as well. And I do honestly believe that there's a corporate plot, you know, for profit, to diagnose people with illnesses that they actually do not have. Okay, that's just another angle of looking at it. But I do feel like that we are aware of that as well. And so the combination of that right there can definitely put a lot of distrust. And then when something is actually wrong, we're saying, no, nothing's wrong with you. They diagnose you like that, but ain't nothing really wrong with you. Don't let them fool you like that, but it could sincerely be something wrong with the individual. And because of our misinformation and not knowing and distrust, you know, the person tends not to be treated. It's a sad fact, but there's definitely a lot of misconceptions regarding the medical field, medical field in that area. So I'm definitely one of the ones that believe that at the end of the day, we definitely need to be see illness in our community. We need to go out. We need to seek help for it. And if it's us and we feel ill, we need to go out and we need to talk to someone.
Totally. I totally agree with what you just said. And it is real. You know, there are lots of cases. There are several cases. You know, the misdiagnosis, the, you know, for-profit, you know, the historical relationship between people, black and brown and red, you know, has been a very shady relationship in the past. And so I do understand skepticism there involved, which is definitely a deterrent for seeking any sort of formal diagnosis and treatment. All right, so we definitely would like to take a moment to remind our guests that if you would like to get in on these conversations, join in on our discussions, to please press the one on your line. But before we do that, I would like to ask our host this evening one additional question, something that comes to mind, you know, as we continue to speak on mental illness in the prisons. I know that you brothers have were formerly incarcerated at some point. Could you speak a little bit about, you know, your experiences, what you may have witnessed, you know, as it relates to mental illness behind bars?
Yes. What I had noticed, I noticed that they start having whole buildings and houses inside buildings and putting what they classify people as mental health inmates, and I guess it was done maybe so they can buy all these drugs and drug them. And another tactic that I see they start using, if like if a person was extremely aggressive, they try to put them on Thorazine or give a person experimental drugs and things of that nature and make them dependent on these drugs. So like if when pill call come or if the pill call is late, these brothers would just go irate. You know what I mean? They think that they needed this medication. So, and it's quite not a few people actually, you know, probably was kind of crazy. So I have ran across a few individuals that, you know, they was missing a few screws loose, but they are not the majority. You see what I'm saying? They're not the majority. So the people that are the majority in these pods and stuff like that are regular people. You know, they and it's like that's how they balloon they numbers and stuff like that. And it's disheartening when you start seeing brothers that you know are strong and you see them a few months down the line, they like zombies. You know, and it's disproportional a lot of brothers of color that they do this to. So, and it's like, it's a scheme. At the end of the day, it's a scheme, you know. It's a scheme. The people that really might need the mental health or need treatment, they don't get the treatment because they get lost in the sauce as well. So, at the end of the day, it's just a diabolical plot just to fill up cells. That's it.
I feel, you know, two things. One, yes, there is definitely a overdiagnosis and misdiagnosis, and it's being used as a way to keep the prison population to a certain degree docile. But as I have had my fair share of mental health work, and I can tell you that my perception over the years has drastically changed. You know, I thought that, you know, people could help it or you know, it wasn't a real thing. But once I actually had the experience of working, you know, in state-run mental health hospitals, I can tell you that there are some very mentally ill individuals of all races in this country who truly have a real psychological issue, who need to be in a real psychological psychiatric facility receiving treatment. And prisons is not that place. That is not the place. It makes it a more dangerous environment for themselves, for other prisoners. But I don't want to, you know, we know that there are a lot of things that are over-exaggerated and just not true, but there are people who are really seriously mentally ill, mm-hmm. definitely, within our prisons.
Yeah,
Brother Christopher Black.
Yes. Yes. I totally agree. It's sound like I'm echoing here.
Yeah, I do hear a tad bit of an echo. No, I just thought you were about to say something. I didn't want
I was ready to contribute to that. Inside the prisons, there are a number of mentally ill prisoners. For the most part, many mentally ill prisoners these days are not getting the treatment. Instead, what prisoners are doing, prisoners are taking shortcuts. They are actually taking prisoners and misdiagnosing them, first of all, in some cases, misdiagnosing them. It's almost like they got a count they're trying to get to feed them medication. The more aggressive ones, like the brother said, they're feeding them medication to make them docile, to make them less aggressive. If they refuse the medicine, they're punched up with it, you know. And these are more your more aggressive prisoners. But the prisoners that are not aggressive, that is something is wrong with, okay? Now, first of all, they're aggressive, and that means they got a reason for doping you up. But it may not be nothing wrong with you. But the ones that are not aggressive and something is wrong with them, they are usually the ones that goes unnoticed, usually the ones that go untreated. I've noticed that. On maximum security prisons, particularly on max units, I've noticed they're sitting in the cell, they'll swallow razors, swallow batteries, try to hang themselves. All they do is take them up on what they call CSI, take them up on there and just put them in a strip cell, butt naked by 7-2 hours, and send them back to the dorm after that, say, you okay. Someone may come through, talk to them for about 10 minutes, okay, he okay, send him back. That type of thing is going on inside the prisons right now. You know, matter of fact, you have major lawsuits that have been won across the country, South Carolina, Illinois. Right now we got a suicide situation out in California out there in the women's prison where they got this high rate of suicides. In New York, they just paid out, I think, like $5.75 billion at the Rockers Island because they found a man in his cell butt naked with his urine and feces all on him, been locked in the cell for 6 days. No one's watching. It is horrible what's going on in these prisons, indefinite prisons. First of all, I don't believe in prisons, not the model that we have today. But prisons is definitely no place for those that have mental illnesses. And I think it's not in the prison industrial complex best interest to allow people that don't have mental illness outside of the system, because you know it's profit loss. So they have to keep everybody in as much as they can. So that is my response to that. That we definitely have many mental illness people coming into the prisons.
I appreciate that. I do. And we are going to get into a great discussion surrounding those very topics that we were just discussing just a moment ago. Just as a reminder, if you would like to get in on our discussions this evening, press the 1 and you will be added to our queue. We are going to take a short break here, but when we come back, we will be joined by Ms. Holly Austin. She will be here to share her story, her experience, to give us some good insight on what it's like to have a loved one caught up in our criminal justice system.
One out of four human beings with their hands on bars, shackled in the world, are locked up here in the land of the free.
Khalif Browder was walking home from a party when he was stopped by police.
And they said, we're going to take you to the precinct, and most likely we're going to let you go home. And then I never went home.
13th 14th Amendment to the Constitution makes it unconstitutional for someone to be held as a slave. There are exceptions, including criminals.
The loophole was immediately exploited. What you got after that was a rapid transition to a mythology of black criminality.
That needed to be controlled.
You better believe it.
It became virtually impossible for a politician to run and appear soft on crime.
The kinds of kids that are called super predatory.
Millions of dollars will be allocated for prison and jail facilities.
Three strikes and you are out.
Enormous burden on the black community, but it also violated a sense of core fairness.
States were required to keep these prisons filled, even if nobody was committing a crime.
It's so difficult to talk about mass incarceration because it has become heavily monetized.
The focus is on taking people from prison, putting them in community corrections, parole, probation.
How much progress is it really if now there's a private company making money off the GPS monitor?
We now have more African Americans under criminal supervision than all the slaves back in the 1850s.
We are the product of the history that our ancestors chose. We are the product of that set of choices that we have to understand in order to escape from it.
All right, then. Crystal, you on?
I am sorry, y'all. My phone was on mute.
All right.
I was just talking. Thank you for stepping in there.
We echoing you.
As I mentioned. Okay, could you please mute your lines? I have to ask everyone to mute their lines if your line is not muted to cut back on the echo that we are experiencing. Thank you. Thank you. I do apologize. My phone was on mute. I'm sorry. I was saying that what you just heard, that was the soundtrack for the 13th documentary that is supposed to come out this upcoming Friday, October the 7th, showing on Netflix. And this is a documentary about the prison industrial complex, the 13th Amendment to the U.S. Constitution, and we are looking forward to that. If you have the opportunity to see that, if you have Netflix, check that out this Friday. It definitely speaks to the work that we are trying to accomplish here with the Millions for Prisoners, Human Rights. But, again, welcome back to our broadcast. We are joined this evening by Holly Alston, and we are so glad to have her with us this evening. Ms. Alston, she is a mental health and prisoners' human rights advocate. She is also the mother of Terrell Scott. And this was a young man. He suffered from mental illness and got caught up in the criminal justice system. Sadly enough, Terrell took his life in August of this year after a long battle. And his mother, Holly, she is here with us this evening to share her family's experience, to inform all of us about the seriousness of these situations, and to offer some suggestions to us. So, again, thank you, Holly, for joining us this evening. Welcome. Are you there, Holly?
Yes, I'm here.
Okay, wonderful. Holly, can you tell us a little bit about your son, Terrell? Could you tell us a little bit about that situation?
Okay, well, overall, Terrell, a very, very shy son. He was very, very nice. He never really showed any signs of anger at any point. But unfortunately, Terrell, he was diagnosed with mental illness at the age of five. Since the age of five, Terrell has been suicidal. Age of five, he tried to hang himself. So it was Charles really had a really long, hard life. And over the years, he was diagnosed saying that he was bipolar. He was definitely diagnosed with social anxiety, meaning that it was very hard for him to be around people. But he was a lovely child. He grew up to be such a beautiful, tall, young black man. But unfortunately, he got in a situation. It was due to my ex-husband being violent. Troll was kicked out of our house at the age of 16 during the wintertime. And unfortunately, he didn't have any place to go. And what happened was he ended up going to Easton. Someone told him to go to Easton. They have places that where the homeless can go. And there was this young woman that was watching my son, and she approached him saying, "Would you like to go inside, get a a warm meal?" And my son still sensed the fact that it was very hard for him to talk to people. He took the offer, and unfortunately, the mother that was there at the place that he went to took advantage of my son. She probably did not realize that my son had mental illness, because then when he speaks, he has a real rich, deep voice, but Terrell is extremely intelligent. So she took advantage of Terrell. She was caught up in children youth due to the fact that she had a child that died mysteriously, and she was not a good parent. Terrell ended up being with her for 4 years. I didn't like the situation, but at that point, Terrell, realizing what type of person this mother was and how she was treating her kids, he did not want them to be taken away from children and youth. So trying to get all of this into perspective, during those 4 years that my son was with this woman, children youth, the Eastern Children Youth caseworkers went to their house twice a week to check on these girls. And these are mandated reporters, such as the children's teachers at the Eastern School District. They were mandated reporters. They went to the summer night program, which was run by one of the pastors in Easton. All these people were mandated reporters. Nobody wrote any type of, and they thrived. The school district, the girls' teachers said they did actually wonderful, because my son actually helped them out. So my son was getting tired of the situation, meaning that because their mother, she would leave. She would get their welfare checks, and she would leave for 2 weeks. And then my son was stuck trying to go to work, trying to deal with her kids, and just trying to just survive on his own. Things did not go well. They ended up moving up to all those the other things I wanted to mention to you happened in Eastern Pennsylvania. Terrell and her. Yes.
Holly, if you don't mind, I'd like to ask a question.
Okay.
Throughout this time period right here, when he was out, when he was released, and he was going through this transitional stage, with the family, and seems like he had a woman and was dealing with some young ones. Was he having medical, mental health treatment at that time period? Was it mental health treatment going on between that time?
During the time that my son was with his woman, my son did not get any mental health help. I kept my son in therapy from the age of 5 to around 15 when he said, "Ma, I think I'll be okay." I didn't agree with it. And we went, the doctor said, "Okay, let's see how things go." And unfortunately, by the time he was 16, he met up with this woman who was 45 years old.
And so, it's my understanding that that situation progressed and that he eventually, ended up in the criminal justice system.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
How I just, you know, how do the courts, when they're, in your experience, how do they determine competency? How do they measure that? Yes, go ahead.
I'm so sorry. Go ahead. I'm sorry to interrupt. I'm sorry.
No, I think that was it. That was just my question. Just, you know, how do they go about that process of determining, you know, the competency?
Well, how it is if, for my son, for instance, is he was in prison, which basically was based on a lie. The woman said that my son did these horrible things to her daughters. But basically, since my son has had a long mental health illness history, they ignored that for some reason with Terrell. They noticed that he had mental illness. They do have a doctor, and it was Dr. Thomas, who was appointed to the prison to deal with anybody that had any mental illness or any type of disorder that was going on. What happens in prison, the prisons will have to write out a paper, a slip, to tell medical to say, I need to see the doctor. Well, this would go on, and Terrell, unfortunately, was not treated well at all because he had the mental illness. And even though he was 6'3", he was extremely shy. So Terrell would try to get these slips in to see the doctor. He never would see the doctor. I even had to go to the doctor's office. And it was really, really hard. But the thing is, basically, a psychiatrist, which might not be a really good psychiatrist, because the majority of the psychiatrists that are in prison, they're not really, really good doctors. Maybe something happens down the line. The prison doesn't care, you know, if this doctor can really evaluate a patient. But that's how it goes. The prison doctor, the psychiatrist will evaluate the patient. If they feel he has mental illnesses, give them whatever regular medications they want to give them and just hope that it works. So that's how it works. That's how it works at Northampton County Prison out here where I live.
Have you? I'm sorry. Go ahead.
Yeah, I was going to ask, like, was he on any type of medication? Well, of course he was. If he went through an evaluation before he went to prison, did they give him the same medicine he had when he was at the mental health facility?
Well, during those 4 years, Terrell wasn't on any medication at all, unfortunately. But I've always been very close to Terrell. If there was ever an issue or anything that would happen, I would always help him. But during that time, he was not medicated.
All right. At what stage did he get medicated?
He started getting medicated when he went into prison. Previously to that, Trell would have suicidal attempts, and he would go to a hospital, and then they would give him medications then. But once he was out, we couldn't afford the medications, and then Trell would kind of go like in a zombie type, not zombie, that's a horrible thing, but like, you know, he wasn't like really aware of anything. Like if he's walking a certain direction, you can actually turn him. So that's what would happen, and unfortunately the prisons gave Terrell what they had or what they thought would be the best for Terrell.
You know, that's interesting that you bring up the fact that, you know, y'all were unable to afford his medications here on the outside, and that is another reality for a lot of people who suffer with mental illness. A lot of families, a lot of Americans, they say that approximately 26% of homeless adults that stay in the shelters, they have a serious mental illness. And then, you know, an estimated 46% live with a severe mental illness and or a substance abuse disorder. So there is no, we as a community need to do better. We need to invest in these services out here in our communities. We need to make sure that people can afford their medication, you know, so they can function and live, you know, somewhat productive lives. And so the issue starts on the outside, and then as you see, it just transfers right into the prison system. But I do just want to add that, Holly, you were speaking about Terrell and,
yeah,
you know, his medications there once he got started on them.
Well, during his incarceration, he was incarcerated altogether for 7 years without going to trial. During the time since Terrell, it was very hard for him to ask for help. They did whatever they wanted to do to him. Terrell was exposed to HIV from another inmate. Terrell was beaten over the head, which caused him to lose part of his vision and his hearing. Terrell's jaw was misaligned. And there was so many other things that happened with Terrell with this medication. He was, you know, raped in prison. But me, I was always very vocal about the medication. They said, look, this is what we have. And it just wasn't the thing for Terrell, especially the fact that he suffered from extreme schizophrenia. He was the attorney that we had was not doing anything to help Terrell's situation. So I don't want, I know if you want me to jump around or continue telling a little bit about what happened to him. Or
can I ask you a question, Holly?
Yeah.
You said that he waited 7 years going fighting his case in jail.
Yeah, he never they his attorney and his attorney Phil Lauer, which was a paid attorney, and also Judge Leonard Zito, they made sure that Terrell was never going to go to trial. Terrell would ask that he would say, look, I want to be able to, you know, say that I'm innocent, and they denied him that. So for 7 years, he did not go to trial.
Wow.
Did he have, the whole time, did they do a post-evaluation for him to actually see what his mental state was?
No. When he was at Northampton County Prison, they didn't do anything like that. He didn't get more of a better evaluation once he was sent to a state hospital. He was pressuring them to say, look, he needs to be in a mental hospital. And basically they admitted to me, said, look, we're just medical. We just house the patient. So Terrell was supposed to get better treatment, medical treatment for his mental illness over at Norristown State Hospital, which turned out to be a disaster. They sent Terrell, they kept Terrell there for 7 months. Terrell lost an enormous amount of weight. Since Terrell had social phobia, he was picked on. It didn't matter if he was 6 feet, he was always picked on. He would sit in front of the team of the doctors there saying, look, so-and-so is bothering me, so-and-so. They would do nothing, and he paced. He paced. Terrell probably went in 7 months, he probably went through at least 10 pairs of shoes. He paced all day like an animal that's in the zoo. And then he had to have his door open. And let's say he didn't want to deal with anybody, they would give him, I don't know what the medication off the top of my head, but they would inject him. They would have the big guys in those white suits hold Terrell down and inject him and knock Terrell out for 3 days.
Wow.
That's what I'm telling you right here is like absolutely nothing. But just to sum it up, Terrell has had 2 suicide attempts. He's been incarcerated. The first one probably happened about maybe 4 years ago, maybe 5 years ago, a Northampton County prison is located in eastern Pennsylvania. The reason why Terrell, he just couldn't take it anymore. During that time, they had housed him with an inmate that had full-blown HIV, and his bloody urine from a catheter bag would get on the floor. They would make Terrell wipe that up without using any type of emergency gloves, anything like that. So he was exposed to that. And also during that time, my other son actually talked to Terrell's accuser. She ended up saying that she was sorry. She didn't know all this was going to happen to Terrell. We immediately told that to his attorney, Phil Lowry. He did nothing with the confession, nothing at all. So Terrell gave up on hope. He would take, they crushed up his medicine, all his psych medicine, and Terrell somehow was able to keep some in his mouth, and he, what he did, he would collect it until he had enough in his cup that for him to take. So, and he told me it took him at least about 3 weeks, and he just sat this cup that would get nasty with flies and everything in it. So I'm at work. The warden from the prison calls me saying, you need to go to Easton Hospital because your son is on life support. And I find out that he was already there for 2 days. It took him 2 days for them to call me.
That is awful.
Mm-hmm. So I go over there. They brought the Easton cops. All these cops were at Easton Hospital. They would not. I said I was not leaving because so many things that they did to Terrell due to a cop lying and all these different things. So I said, no, I'm not leaving. I was where they were going to pull the plug. So basically, they didn't know how long Terrell had been unconscious. And I was told by other prisoners that when they found Terrell in his cell unconscious, they were trying to pick him up, and they dropped. First, they dropped him, and they're actually kicking him. So I think that's how his jaw got broken. But that's another thing.
Well, Holly, I'm sorry. That is, you know, so sad, so terrible to hear about those things that, you know, Terrell experienced. You know, he was clearly in the wrong place, clearly did not need to be in anyone's prison. Let me ask you, you know, what do you feel that we can do to assist those? What should family members do? How should we assist our loved ones who are behind bars and we know that they have, or we suspect they have a mental illness?
That's a hard question to answer because our situation is such a grave situation. First of all, it has to come from the government. And you were absolutely correct when they closed down all the hospitals. It really affected those who had mental illness. And this housing. And the thing is, I don't know in all areas of the United States, but out here, the prisons are privatized. So they get $1,000 a day for someone who has mental illness. Okay? So this is money for them. And it starts with the government saying, okay, we need to really look into mental illness. But the issue that I have, if your mental illness or if you are of color, if you are a poor white, whatever, if you have mental illness, you are going to have a horrible time in prison. They do not care. They don't care. Those the correction officers, the staff. They have a God mentality. The other prison that Terrell, they sent him to state prison. There's a prisoner in Florida that was burnt, was scalded to death in the prison shower. And they had another prisoner pick up his skin that fell off his body and put him in the shoe. So when Terrell was in retreat prison and people heard about the story, he actually told the prisoners, look, Scott, because they called my son Scott, his last name. Scott's in the shower. Let me know if you want me to turn the water on hot. Okay? The second attempt, I know I'm all over the place. I'm just trying to tell you what happened at retreat prison. Terrell could not be, he was being forced, coerced to get money for other prisoners. They did anything they wanted to do to Terrell. There's one particular inmate who was a lifer, and he killed 4 people in 14 would show Terrell the pictures of his victims, saying, do you want to be like this if you don't do this? Terrell couldn't take it anymore. Why retreat prison? Allow my son to have razors because Northampton County did it. My son was able to get, this is in December of last year, was able to get 3 razors, disposable 3 razors, those blue Bic ones. And Terrell stood on a table in front of all the correction officers and the prison because it was the day room. And my son's 6'3", okay? He took his Johnny, and he ripped it open. He swallowed 2 of the razor blades, which I found out later got embedded into his chest. And with the 3rd razor, he took it and he cut his neck 3 times from ear to ear. Then he quickly cut his wrist from to his forearms. About 6 to 8 times, which later gave him nerve damage because his hands got stuck, okay? The Summit Correction Officers told me it was worse if something in Oz or a horror movie. They didn't even do anything. They didn't even help Joe immediately. He went to his cell bleeding. He's laying on that metal slab, if you want to call it, a bed, and he said he could feel the life just pouring out of him. Then they took him to the hospital. They checked on him. They said, oh, yeah, I guess we better take him to the hospital. Go ahead. I'm sorry.
I was just going to say that it looks like we've got a few callers that would like to ask you something. This is such intriguing story that you share with us, and but let me allow our caller to ask you a question. I do want to be mindful of the time this evening, and so I do have a caller calling in from 3215. If you would like to ask, have you have a question or a comment? Your line is open. Again, the last four digits of your phone number is 3215.
Hi, my name is Adam, and I just want to make a comment to Holly.
Hi, Adam.
Hi, Holly. My heart goes out to you, and I want to thank you for being so brave and for Terrell for being so brave. I'm just listening here, a bit aghast that we can do this to anybody else, what's happened to your son, and I'm terribly sorry.
Okay, I appreciate you saying that. Appreciate that.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Thank you for joining. Thank you for that comment. Definitely. We do appreciate you, Holly, for coming out. I know that this is, you know, difficult for you to share this story related to Terrell, but there are so many people that you're helping when you tell this story. It really brings the awareness out. I was reading somewhere that you have something called Terrell A. Scott Suicide Prevention Grassroots Campaign. Could you tell us briefly about that? And is that something that, our callers, our listeners could support you on?
Yeah. Well, basically, just because my son took his life, Terrell was in three different categories. He was in one for mental illness, one for a prisoner. He was innocent. And then also because he was suicidal. So now I don't want my son to die in vain. And I want it to be my mission, whatever I can do as far as acknowledge, giving someone a prisoner or a family member information, resources, I'm willing to do that. I don't want another family member to have to go through what I'm going through. And it's just really, and this is all over the United States. Like I said, also people who have mental illness, they get more money than the average prisoner. So that's what my mission is going to be now.
How can we stay in touch with you? How can our callers what's the best way for us to stay in contact with you?
Well, if anybody has Facebook, you can find me on Facebook under Holly Alston. My last name is spelled Alston. Also, if you want to go on YouTube, I have Terrell's suicide or the bye video. You can go on the YouTube under Your Girl, and that's going to be a U-R, then G-I-R-L, Your Girl Holly, or just put in Terrell's goodbye video. And also in there, you'll see, if you scroll down a little bit, that I have the conspiracy of Terrell Scott. And this is actually a recording of Terrell's probation officer who knew that Terrell was in the hospital but yet lied on Terrell saying that he missed his probation when he knew that Terrell was in a mental hospital. And then they lied, and that's how they sent Terrell to state prison. But that's where people can find me.
Thank you. Thank you so much, Holly. It has been very interesting, very informative to hear your story. Definitely, I agree with so much of what you said. We look forward to having you on our No Shackles radio program again, and I definitely encourage our listeners to learn more, know more about mental illness here in our prisons across the country, and definitely get behind Holly Alston as she continues to spread the message throughout the country. Once again, we are nearing the end of our program. I want to thank you all for tuning in this evening, but before we go, I did want to ask either of my co-hosts this evening if they have any words that they would like to say.
Yes, I'd like to say, man, we got to try to get a movement going on to abolish private prisons. I think that a lot of stuff that her son went through was because that he was at a private prison or private jail, and their whole concept is to give the least amount of services that they can for they can get the most out the bottom line. And it's no way feasible possible that anybody should be being arraigned and going through the court process for 7 years. That's crazy. So you see the profiteer aspect of it, and you see why it's valuable that we got to ban the 13th Amendment, but under banning the 13th Amendment, we got to rally against private prisons. Because that was, when she said that, I was like, wow. Now I see why he went through everything that he did through, because at the end of the day, he had poor services, he had poor skilled people. Everything was poor around the board, but it all started with because they know that they was trying to maximize their profit. So how can you give anybody the best treatment when you're trying to maximize your profit? And I think that, you know, that's something that got to be looked in as a whole, you know, because that was a diabolical story based off of private prison. That's what I got to say.
Thank you so much for that, Brother Malak. And I did want to, before we end this evening, I did want to take a moment here to give a few announcements or updates. One thing I did want to mention is that the planning and organizing for the upcoming Million for Prisoners Human Rights March on Washington is well underway. We are really working hard on the outside here to connect with people all throughout the country, in every city, in every state. We have several local representatives. We continually need more local representatives. So if that is something that is of interest to you, please reach out to us at the Millions for Prisoners March at gmail.com account. In addition to that, we are also searching currently for additional radio hosts. So if you would like to be a part of No Shackles Radio, if you have skills or talent in this area, we would love for you to join our team and be a part of this. In addition to that, we do want to put out two reminders. I've mentioned this a time or two before, but we definitely want to remind you all to submit the names of any sort of congressmen or lawmakers that you feel may be friendly to our cause and to try to help us accomplish our goals as it pertains to the 13th Amendment. We are working hard. We are trying to dismantle the prison industrial complex, replace these ineffective, inhumane systems with more rehabilitation, more reentry like programs. Take the profit out of it. In addition to that, as we prepare to mobilize and organize and work our way to Washington, D.C. next August, we are needing people who have knowledge or information on mass transportation sources, such as bus lines, charter buses, train even, but we are working hard to develop our plans for people to actually make it to Washington, D.C. So if you have knowledge or information on those areas, please, again, email those to the Millions for Prisoners, March at Gmail. At this time, I do want to, again, thank our host, thank our co-host, thank our guest, Holly, this evening for joining us. Next week, tune in
for another No Shackles program. It, again, will be focused on the people, for you all, about you. Our People's Platform Saturday is next week. So if you have things that are going on in your community, experiences, stories, insights, anything that you would like to discuss as it relates to prisoners, the prison system, abolishment, family matters, as it relates to our prisoners, we would love to have you call in next week to our People's Platform week. With that being said, I thank you all for tuning in to the No Shackles radio program this evening. Peace, stay strong, and we shall win.